Arm Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast here to share a winning strategy for Father's Day from our partners at Sterling Roastery. If your dad treats his morning coffee like a pregame ritual, you need to introduce him to the Sterling Roastery lineup. This isn't that stale, over-roasted stuff sitting on our grocery shelf. Sterling roasts their beans multiple times a week for unbeatable freshness. The smart play? A coffee subscription. He gets to choose his grind, from French press to espresso, and his favorite roast, depth. It's a world-class lineup of Java that shows up like a reliable veteran on a perennial powerhouse team. Go to sterlingsoap.com and set him up. He'll thank you with every cup. That's sterlingsoap.com.
University of Southern California has had some really exciting eras of football history, and one of them, the most recent, is the Pete Carroll era. We're going to talk about how the ups and downs of that era and some history before that with our special guest today, coming up.
Check it out, Pigskin Dispatch video. Yeah, woohoo!
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pig Pen, your portal to positive football history. And we are in for a special treat. We're going to talk about football out on the West Coast tonight with a Times News award-winning author, Monty Burke, and his latest book that's out, Men of Troy, The Epic Afternoons, Wild Nights, and Enduring Legacy of Pete Carroll's USC Trojans. Monty Burke, welcome to the Pig Pen.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for having me here.
Yeah, Monty, this is a book. I just got done reading this, and what a book. I mean, not only are you telling the story of, you know, Pete Carroll at USC, just like the title reads, but the history that you're going into, which, you know, us here at Pigskin Dispatch and our fans, you know, that's what we really get into it. And you cover both, and it was really, really a great book.
I love it. I mean, I did that sort of selfishly because I loved researching all this stuff. I like to know, like, you know, how college football started, where the first games were. It's funny because it had kind of a manifest destiny, sort of like the country did, right? It kind of like started in the Northeast and went a little south, and then it went west. And, you know, the anchor school out there was and always has been USC. So I love kind of tracing it up to, like, you know, how does USC get a football team? When does Notre Dame go out there for the first time? You know, who founded the College of USC, you know, how they get the mascot name, all that kind of stuff. So it was so fun. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I did not know that story, how they became the Trojans. That was a great piece you had in there. You got me right from the drop, you know, your introduction. You know, I always say, you know, a great piece of art is, you know, something that stokes emotion, whether it be music or a painting or a sculpture or literary, and you took me into that 2006 national championship game against Texas, and I had emotions of me sitting on the edge of my couch, and I didn't have rooting interest in either team, but I just love watching football, and that was like quite a game, and you took me right there again. Great way to start.
I love that lead. I knew I was going to probably have to lead with that game, since it's sort of the, you know, it's, some people consider it the greatest title game ever played. You know, it was, USC was pretty much 6 inches away from winning three national titles in a row. So, you know, if Lindell White had converted a fourth down, so they were like that far away from immortality. So I sort of figured, you know, I need to start there and then I'll go back and trace some more history. But that the actual sort of lead, what Carroll, and I won't spoil it here, but what Carroll kind of says at the bottom of the first part of the lead there just kind of plopped in my lap. You know, I mean, that's when you interviewed a ton of different players. You know, I wasn't necessarily asking this guy like what Carroll said or whatever, but he just kind of, like, in the course of our 2-hour interview, he just was like, oh, and by the way, I went over on the sidelines and he said this. So anyway, I love that. To me, leads in movies or books or even music, like, you got to love it. You got to get hooked right from the beginning, and then you want to make people keep turning the pages. But, you know, if you don't get them in the first 20 pages or something like that, you could be in trouble.
Yeah, most definitely. But you definitely did that. You put a check mark there. You definitely did that for this reason.
All right, cool.
Definitely. Yeah. So, but, you know, so we know of Pete Carroll, you know, until recently, you know, his time with the Raiders, not so good. You know, just recently he was fired with them after 1 year. But he had sort of an auspicious start before he had greatness with USC and later on the NFL. Maybe you could just go over that a little bit, sure. And how you lead in.
So he's such an interesting guy. I mean, I wrote another book about Nick Saban, and what was interesting about this book is because Pete's pretty much the polar opposite in philosophy. So, he's a kid who grows up in the Bay Area, San Francisco. He's very influenced by the Summer of Love. He studies psychology, kind of gets into Far Eastern mysticism and all this sort of stuff. And very early on, he decides he's going to be a player's coach, which, at the time in particular was an incredibly derogatory term. He was a defensive genius, a lot like Nick Saban, actually, in that they both were undersized safeties in college who wanted to play pros but didn't make it. So he kind of channeled all that energy into coaching. Defensive genius, has a couple defensive coordinator jobs, gets to the Jets, coaches there for 1 year. It's a disaster. The first thing at the first press conference, he says, there'll be no rules. And the Jets owner, one of my favorite scenes in the book, Jets owner sitting there with his arms crossed, and he kind of rolls his eyes like, what the heck have I gotten into here? So goes 6-10 that year, gets fired after a year, takes a couple of years out with the 49ers as the defensive coordinator, then gets hired by the Patriots, lasts there for 3 years. Every year the record kind of declines. Again, his problem was, he had a good idea for being an unorthodox coach, like, have some psychology involved. Most of all, have it be fun. That was his kind of thing. He thought that, if it was fun, that you get your peak performance out of everybody. They get creative and they get, that you get their peak performance, basically. So what he didn't have was any kind of discipline and rules all around that. So that's why he failed as an NFL coach. He was so kind of off the radar that he had to spend an entire year out of football because no one hired him. And so, here he is, this guy fired twice, a year out of football, probably down to his last strike. If you get fired 3 times within a short, window there, your days as a head coach are probably over. You're a coordinator for life. So, here he is. And USC, on the other hand, is this storied program, which has in reality gone through at this point about 2 decades of just not being relevant nationally, just not a good team that, and they offered the job to one, two, three, maybe even four people before they got to Carroll, depending on who you talk to. So finally get a guy because no one else wants the job. And then he gets hired there and people just go berserk. The alums, the boosters, the administrators, the fans, the LA media, they just go like, why did we hire this guy? He's been fired twice. He hasn't been in college in 15 years, all this kind of stuff. So rough beginning there. Then has a really rough start to his first year, goes 1-4. And, I mean, people are ready to rip everybody's head off. And then it just turns around. He that style, that unorthodox style he had really worked with college kids. It was a great place to test it. These are impressionable younger kids. They are at that point were a captive audience for 3 or 4 years. They're not that anymore, but they were then. And he really turned it around. I mean, it helped. He had some good building blocks there with Carson Palmer and Troy Polamalu, but then those guys graduated, and here we have Matt Leinart and Reggie Bush and Lendale White and 2 championships in a row. And then, like I said, that, literally 6 inches away from icing that game to go 3 in a row, 3 titles in a row, which no one's ever done in the modern era. And just created this incredible vibe out there too. I mean, it was like, there were no NFL teams then, in LA, and, LA folks, business people and celebrities, they love winners. USC started winning. The next thing you know, all these celebrities are flocking there. Carroll, unlike other coaches, had totally open practices. He didn't care who came. You could have a scout from another team. He didn't care. But, all of a sudden at games, you'd have Arnold and Will Ferrell and Snoop Dogg and the Fonz and stuff like that. But also they came to practices as well. So it was like this crazy, unique time that had never happened before. And I'm pretty sure it's never going to happen again because the NCAA shut it down so hard. But it was like, so to me, that was what was super intriguing about writing this book.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting that he rose so quickly. This is a time of like stoic coaches having success, like Tressel and Saban, and then you got Pete Carroll come in, his failure in the NFL, and comes in and just blows it up and really takes over the NCAA by command.
I
Almost
mean,
a three-peat,
they captured not only the city of Los Angeles, but they kind of hijacked the sport there for a little while. I mean, they were it. And what was cool too is he sort of reestablished to me, sort of reestablished the Pac-12. I mean, when I was those years before that, I remember watching, you'd click on the Pac-12 game at 11 o'clock at night here on the East Coast, and you were guaranteed to have fun because there was no defense, right? It was just guys slinging it all over the place. It was really fun. So he brought this sort of, not only was he this great recruiter, He was a naturally a good recruiter, but once the stars started showing up, I talked to a couple guys who were in high school, and they'd like, "Yeah, I visited and I met Snoop," and I was like, "I was going to USC, right?" So he recruited really well too. But he also brought this kind of defense. I mean, they had some great defense. We forget, they had one team where they had Cushing, Brian Cushing, and Clay Matthews III on the same team in the linebacking core. I mean, they had some pretty incredible defenses. So in a way, USC was kind of the rising tide that lifted all boats. I mean, the Pac-12 had to. Once he whipped their butts for 4 or 5 years, the other schools kind of, got their act together, and Stanford hired Jim Harbaugh, Oregon got it going with Chip Kelly. I mean, it really rose the whole level of the Pac-12. And then I feel like when the sanctions hit, which USC, by the way, has not recovered from still, we're almost 20 years out now, and they're still not really now. I mean, they had a decent year last year. Maybe they're on the cusp of doing something, I don't know, but they haven't been nationally relevant really since then. When that tide went out and USC sunk, they were the anchor program out there, right? And so the whole conference suffered. And to a certain degree, I think you can, like, there's a thin thread needle there where you can look at the demise of USC and how it's connected to the demise of the Pac-12.
Yeah, I loved how you alluded to that throughout the book of, it rising up, and then it when that ship sinks, the whole Pac-12 started sinking. So, yeah, very, very interesting parallel you had there. But you go into some detail of some football history that's more of a modern time, including the gentleman that ended up hiring Pete Carroll, who was a USC star himself. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so that was Mike Garrett, who was USC's first Heisman winner. He was a real hero back in the 60s. He was this hard-nosed, he was one of those running backs. You don't see him quite as much these days, but one of those running backs back in the day who seemed to relish contact. Like, there'd be a guy in front of him, he could run around him, but he decided to run the guy over anyway. So he was kind of like this hard-nosed, straightforward kind of guy. And he'd been at USC. He inherited John Robinson, who, of course, was a famous USC coach, but this was John Robinson's second stint, which seemed to me to never work. I mean, I remember when Joe Gibbs went back to what was then called the Washington Redskins, and you just knew it was going to be a fiasco, and it turned out to be a fiasco. So he inherits Robinson, has to fire him, doesn't do it very politely. He does it over the phone, answering machine, I believe. And then he hires this guy named Paul Hackett, who is Nathaniel Hackett's father, was supposed to be this NFL offensive genius. And he's just, he's not a total disaster, but it's like a lot of mediocrity, a lot of like 6 and 6 seasons. So what's interesting is that Garrett is kind of down to his third strike too. He's just like his coach that he's hired. And I love talking to Garrett because now he's all like, "Oh yeah, no, I knew Pete was the guy. I knew from the beginning he was the guy." And he's like, "Really, man? I didn't see it. I don't know about that." The other people dispute that notion, but it was he's kind of an interesting character. He kind of Carroll, one of the central questions, at least in the early part of the book, is did USC save Pete Carroll or did Pete Carroll save USC? And it's a really interesting question because, his philosophy, he figured out how to make it work, that unorthodox thing, and then he took it to the NFL and it worked there for a little while. Worked there pretty much until the last like 2 years of the Seahawks, and obviously didn't work there last year with the Raiders, but it worked very, very well for 12 seasons,
Yeah, most definitely. It seems like Coach Carroll, and I didn't really realize this, the amount of coaching, assistant coaching power that he ended up putting on his staff almost immediately. Maybe you could talk about some of these names because these guys are really important to
Yeah.
success.
I mean, so what's interesting too, so he comes into USC and he knows he has to win. He knows that this is his third strike. If he gets fired, he's, like I said, a coordinator for life, which he definitely didn't want to be. His mentor was Monty Kiffin, Lane Kiffin's father, who was a head coach for about 3 years and then was a coordinator for life. So he'd seen what that's like. He liked to be the head guy. So he comes in, and what's really interesting about his first staff is he puts his ego completely aside and says, "I'm going to hire the best guys out there." So he hires a bunch of, some NFL guys, some guys with some college ties. He brings in Norm Chow, who's a name maybe some of your listeners know, but Norm was the longtime offensive coordinator at BYU, and he had tutored Jim McMahon and Steve Young and Ty Detmer. He had a couple Heisman winners under his belt. So he was this sort of offensive genius who had done all of this with, like, not necessarily BYU never really had the most skilled players, but he designed this incredible offense where, I think one season Steve Young might have averaged 350 or 400 yards a game passing. Like, it's just some insane stats, right? So then he keeps Ed Orgeron from the old staff, the only person he really keeps. And that guy is, I think, probably the best defensive line coach in college football history. I mean, he coached Warren Sapp, Russell Maryland, just to name a few. And he becomes the kind of enforcer of the staff, which is very important. And then, interestingly, he hires these two young bucks, guys kind of out of nowhere a little bit, who aren't much older than the players they're coaching. And one of them is kind of a nepo hire. So he hires Lane Kiffin because Monty Kiffin was his mentor. He used to babysit Lane Kiffin when Lane Kiffin was Pete used to babysit Lane Kiffin when he was a toddler for the Kiffins. And then he hires this other guy named Steve Sarkisian, who you might have heard of. So you got these two young, brash guys who, have a lot to kind of learn in terms of, management and not being too crazy, but they are immediately identified as offensive geniuses. I mean, they're just kind of know the game. And it's fascinating to me, actually, when I was interviewing Lane, he pointed out, and he put this together, not me, but his three biggest mentors in his life. So Lane Kiffin is known as an offensive genius, right? But his three biggest mentors in his life were his father, who invented the Tampa 2 defense, one of the most famous defensive coordinators in NFL history, Nick Saban, of course, a man known for his defense, and Pete Carroll, another defensive guy. Pete Carroll was the defensive coordinator at USC for all but the last 2 years, basically. So it's just so interesting that a guy like Lane would be made out of these three mentors who were all defensive guys, but Lane would point, he pointed out, he said, if you looked at Pete, you know what he did, and he looked the way that he acted and how creative he was, how energetic he was, how many ideas were flying out of his head, you'd think he was an offensive coordinator, not a defensive coordinator. Those guys tend to be kind of stern, like Saban, and not, they don't talk very much. So it is fascinating stuff. Great staff.
Excellent. And Sarkisian, what, did he played for under Chow, right?
He
Who's
did.
Chow was his
He
coordinator
was
at
one of those,
BYU.
I didn't realize this until going in there, but the JUCO thing in California, I don't know if it's still like this. I don't think it's still like this, but that used to be like a real breeding ground for great players. I mean, so many great players came from junior. They go play somewhere for 2 years, get their grades up or whatever, and then they transfer into UCLA or USC. And Sarkisian was one of those guys. He transferred to BYU from El Camino Community College. And Sark had this, I think Sark stats were insane. It was like 49 TDs and four interceptions, but he was just an insane player, and then was pretty much out of football. He was like selling modular computer chairs, basically, chairs for working. It's just, and then Norm kind of plucked him out of that, helped Pete identify him, and they plucked him out, and the rest is history. I mean, those two guys, they've been, both of those guys have been through a lot of bumps and bruises. It's taken a long time to get where they are, but they are, two of the best coaches in college football right now.
Yeah, I loved how you sort of told how their personalities were, t almost polar opposites. And I know a little bit about Pete Carroll because I listen to Sirius Radio, and he's good friends with Pat Kirwan. Kirwan has him on every week, and he could be, like this year, he had a terrible season going on, but the dude is so high energy coming on and talking after you're just getting shellacked a couple of days earlier. And Norm Chow, the way you described him, how did this work out? It was almost like an odd couple type
Yeah,
situation.
totally. I mean, so everybody else, Pete wanted energy out of all of his assistants, just like he wanted out of his players. They took away sprinting in the, they didn't do the gassers at the end of practice because he wanted people, instead, he wanted people to get their sprints in while they were sprinting from station to station during the practice. Genius stuff. He was always moving like this totally kinetic guy. He insisted that all of his assistants work out in the morning so that and eat well. And he'd bring them breakfast every morning. And, they're all rah-rah guys, except for Norm Chow, who was this very kind of very quiet, still is, never had a hair out of place, just wasn't a rah-rah guy. And it worked. I mean, it was kind of good to have that. It was like ballast, it was the ship would go back and forth with all these crazy, personalities, and Norm was always there. Norm was always one of the first people in the office, and Ed Orgeron would go and burn his ear up, and people had complaints, they'd go to Norm. He was like the almost the paternal presence there, I'd say, even though he wasn't much, he was older than most people, but he wasn't that much older. But he was very much like the sort of or almost grandfatherly presence, right? And so it was a real, those two, I don't want to spoil too much of it, but those two had a rift, Carol and Chow, and part of it had to do with their differing personalities, but another part of it had to do is that Norm was getting a ton of credit for USC success, for grooming, two Heisman quarterbacks, for designing an explosive offense that, it would win games 77 to 10. So part of that had to do with Norm's getting a lot of the credit. I want to try something different. I want to try my guys that are, he considered Lane and Sark kind of his guys, so he lets Norm go. They classified it as a mutual separation, but it was definitely not mutual. Norm actually says in the book that he would have preferred to stay if he could. And then Sark and Kiffin take over, and it's just fireworks from there. I mean, they're always like, deep ball here and, throw it long, and a lot of pressure on the Stars. They put a whole lot of pressure on the Stars, but it was, it was electric, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, it definitely was, and you sell that in the book too. You got me fired up in the beginning. You tell a little bit of history, and then you get me fired up and ramped up for going sometimes game by game in some of these pivotal seasons of Pete Carroll at USC, and just a really a joy to read and to
Good, thank you.
remember. Yeah. So what do you think? I know you talk about this a little bit. Pete Carroll was smart enough to realize as he was going through his coaching stints and his failures of picking up on things and learning some things and adopting and adapting. What do you think sort of took him to that USC point? What were some of the biggest changes he made from the Jets where he had no rules?
I think it was. For one, he spent that whole season he was out of football. Aside, he and Kerwin tried to start something that sounded an awful lot like what would become the NFL Network. It's a very good idea. They didn't have any funding for it. But other than that, he spent a lot of time holed up in his New Hampshire lake house, looking out at the white snow and just writing down like his philosophy, sort of. I mean, he loved John Wooden, and he reread Wooden's famous book, which is called The Blue Book, which is kind of outlines John Wooden's philosophy. And But I think a lot of it had to just do with discipline. I mean, he just had to figure out how to keep it fun, keep it loose, but keep it within parameters, right? I mean, there's this you can't have the inmates running the asylum, basically, which is kind of what he had at the Jets and the Patriots. But again, the kids are younger, right? And you've got so much control. If they mess up, if a pro player messes up, they're not going to study hall from 8 to 11. I mean,
Right.
they're going home. So these kids, if they messed up, put them in study hall. If they messed up, Ed Orgeron gets them up at 5 o'clock and they do gassers in the morning. I mean, so there's so much more control over these kids. But I think a lot of it was just, evolving into, just him getting a little more mature and realizing that, he had a little affirmation card that he wrote that he kept in his car that said, "I will coach this team with discipline today." So a lot of it was just that.
Yeah. So you talk, a lot, not only about Pete, but you talk about a lot about the players. You have, a great background on Matt Leinart and Reggie Bush and, some of these other great players from that era of USC football. What was maybe one of the most surprising items that you did during your research that you wrote about?
I mean, there was a lot. I'll start with Leinart because I vaguely knew Leinart's backstory, but I didn't know it quite that well. And I didn't realize that he was, as a kid, he was obese and cross-eyed. He had something called strabismus, which is just a natural, born kind of cross-eyed. And he was, mercilessly picked on as a kid. Every once in a while, his older brother would step in. But this was back before there was like a national conversation about bullying, right? You just kind of, if you got bullied, you kind of grinned and bared it. But it dug into his soul, And eventually, he got his eyes fixed. And this is like the swan story, right? The fairy tale. But
The
he
ugly
becomes this
duckling type thing.
exactly ugly duck. This is the ugly duckling thing. So he. And then he, ninth grade, all of a sudden he kind of grows tall and like has muscles and stuff like this and becomes this incredible athlete, like great basketball player, great baseball player, and phenomenal quarterback. And, I feel like one thing that just kept, Leinart always kept that hurt close to him a little bit, right? As a motivator, as something that like, he just never forgot it, right? And in some ways that's what he much tougher quarterback than we give him credit for, had some bad injuries at USC, played through him. Great leader. And then, what's interesting, I was talking about the celebrities earlier. To a certain degree, Reggie Bush and he, but particularly Matt Leinart, became as famous, if not more famous, than some of the celebrities who were coming to watch the team. I mean, Matt Leinart, I was looking through old issues of People Magazine and Us Weekly, which were the sort of gossip rags back then. He's all over them. He's out there with Britney Spears and he's out there with Paris Hilton, the documenting him coming out of the Chateau Marmont, all this kind of stuff. So this guy is a college kid is part of that sort of what we call now the TMZ kind of universe, right? People are following him around. And one of my favorite anecdotes in the book is after practice one day, Will Ferrell comes up to Leinart and says, "You want to go have lunch?" And they go sit down and have lunch. And a student comes up and asks for Leinart's autograph, and not Will Ferrell's, which I love. I mean, to me, that was sort of emblematic of the whole thing. So, I loved all that stuff. I loved getting Carol's. It's cool to interview people after they've had a little. There's some distance now between these things. They've had time to kind of really think about it. They've had time to hopefully be more honest about it. I feel like, if you interview people 3 years after the run's over or 5 years, they can be a little, their heads are still messed up about it. But to get, Lane Kiffin's point of view on, not only Dynasty, but specific plays like the Bush Push, like what was the call there? Or what was the call on, Lendale White's, missed fourth down in the USC Texas. So to get all that insight from Carroll and Kiffin, but also the players, to talk to Lendale White about what it felt like to, not quite make it. And then, I mean, I don't know if you remember this or if your listeners remember it, but in the national title game, USC was kind of rolling early, and they had a screen pass that went to Reggie Bush, and he just rumbled down the field, 60 some yards. And it looked like, okay, here the route is going to be on. And just as he was being tackled, out of nowhere, he tries to lateral it back to this guy who was a walk-on, who was there basically as a blocking receiver, and it was a terrible lateral. Not this guy, it wasn't this guy's fault at all. He didn't catch it. Texas jumps on it. They go down and score. The whole game has changed on that. So to get, I interviewed that walk-on. What was it like? What were you doing out there? What did it feel like? And it was kind of sort of sad in some ways because he still is. He's not remembered for the father he is, or the husband he is, or what he does for his work. He's, "Oh, you didn't catch that lateral." That's what people say to him when they come up to him. So, we forget there's like little human stories within all of these stories as well. So I just love all that stuff.
Yeah, it's brilliantly done. Why don't you give us the name of your book again and where folks can get a copy?
It's called Men of Troy, and it better damn well be in your local bookstore. If it's not, you can ask them to get one. It's also on Amazon if you prefer that. And I can be reached through my website if you want to, talk to me about it. I love chatting with people who've read it, even people who have beefs with it. I got no problem. Bring it on. Let's go. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's a great story, folks. It's a controversial story, because it was in the public eye, and so really brought a bad light into football. But the history of the book and the journalism that you did on this is excellent, and I highly recommend it. And we really thank you for joining us, Monty, and good luck with the sale of the book.
Of course. Thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate it.
That's all the football history we have today, folks. Join us back tomorrow for more of your football history. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hi, everyone. There's a new podcast in town, Statman and Robin. We are the dynamic duo of Baltimore sports history.
We have lots of stories to tell about the great and not so great teams and players in Baltimore's rich sports history, and some of the more obscure ones too.
We grew up together with these teams and players, and we'll add our experiences to these great stories.
Yep, we were there for a lot of them. Join us here on the Sports History Network.